Welcome to the Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman. We're going to have our USC expert Antonio Morales on here in a little bit, partially to talk about how USC is looking in the spring, but also because he went to San Diego State. And guess what? Big, big moment for San Diego State over the weekend. And speaking of Trader Joe's, our wonderful sponsor, Bruce, have you, if you're watching basketball, right, and you're looking for a snack, have you had the blue corn tortilla chips at Trader Joe's?
Stu, I actually, I don't think I ever had them until about a week ago, and my wife had ended up buying them. And I got to admit, never mind basketball, it was like just, I kept on eating them. They were really, really good. So next time you're at Trader Joe's, definitely get them. They're like a great snack. It's like one of, like, add it to the list of all the stuff you get there that's like, can't get this anyplace else, and it's really good.
Yeah, I've been watching, obviously, a lot of basketball over the last couple of weeks.
I feel like it's one of the few things, Stu, you and I have in common. Is we don't have very similar tastes that line up, but when it comes to when we were talking about that offline, I was like, oh, he likes them too. It's, at least you don't are not on the same page.
Well, we're definitely never on the same page of music and pop culture, but, you know, we do enjoy sports and a lot of the same Trader Joe's products, so that's good. Let's get to our guest, the esteemed USC writer Antonio Morales. We are pleased to be joined now by The Athletic's expert on all things USC, all things Southern California recruiting, and San Diego State superfan, Antonio Morales. It is the Monday morning after the Aztecs advanced to their first ever Final Four. How are we doing today, Antonio?
It's a good day in Southern California. San Diego State, first Final Four. I think it's UCLA has only been to one Final Four in the past 15 years or so. And USC hasn't been to one, so San Diego State making their moves as things start to shift out here.
I just realized that, like, two of the three of us have Final Four teams as our alma maters. And I almost went to FAU, so that was, I never would have saw that coming.
You know what? I've got to be honest, Bruce. I didn't even think about that. How are you? Are you pretty fired up too?
I'm okay with it. I had one funny moment at home. I shouldn't say this too loud because somebody in the house will hear this, but like at one point watching the FAU game, I commented to my wife, I said, Vlad Golding looks like a really tall Brady Quinn. And it was like, I got such scorn. It was like, I could say something about somebody else, but it was like, you know, just like, no, he doesn't. It was like, kind of like so dismissive of that. It's been a fun weekend of, you know, basketball is a fun weekend. Like, honestly, I got sucked into Iowa women's basketball to watch the Caitlin Clark show. And, you know, just to come back to Antonio's point, like, for you, I'm curious, like, is this very surreal to see your alma mater not only in discussions or, you know, maybe moving on out of the Group of Five world and now also as a Final Four team? Like, they're obviously Kawhi Leonard. There's been some great players. Michael Cage, I know he's way before your time. Certainly Tony Gwynn as a basketball, baseball guy. But how does it feel to see your alma mater at this level?
It's definitely surreal just because 20 years ago, I remember when Steve Fisher made his first NCAA tournament and they got blown out and it took him about 10 years to win a tournament game. It was the Kawhi team and they went to the Sweet 16 that year and fell short to UConn. And then obviously about another 10 years go by and you have the 2020 team that was 26-0 and they probably would have been a one or a two seed and they probably would have made a run to the Elite Eight or something. And I thought that was San Diego State's best team. And then COVID canceled the tournament. I feel like that really hurt SDSU and Dayton this year. So just good to see them in the Final Four and make that run. They're going to have a lot of the whole week in the spotlight this year. And it's just, I think the surreal thing is just how people talk about SDSU now when you read stories. They're like, oh, good academic school, and you know, they're poised to go to the Pac-12 because when I My first year was 2010, but you know, growing up in San Diego, like good academic school and stuff like that, like wasn't the rep that San Diego State had. It's like, oh, this is a party school and a safety school and stuff like that. You heard that a lot. And now I think the basketball programs helped kind of change the reputation of the schools, like how much they've won and kind of how successful they've been over the past decade or so.
Well, you know, with the Pac-12 discussion, obviously football drives realignment and everybody, you know, will say, oh, they're a decent football program, right? They had Donnell Pumphrey, they had Rashad Penny. They've never had that like breakthrough, you know, season like Tulane had last mm-hmm. year, but they're a good football program. And basketball never really came up. And I feel like this is a good reminder to people that like, they've had a heck of a basketball program for 10, 12 years now. Like you said, that going back to Kawhi Leonard. And I know they became kind of famous for their student section. This couldn't come at a better time. I don't know that, you know, based on our reporting, everybody just assumes it's a done deal. I don't know mm-hmm. that the Pac-12 presidents had necessarily reached a universal agreement that they even want to expand, much less San Diego State. If they do that, they're the first call. And I feel like now they have to. Like, if you pass on a program that just went to the Final Four and has a good football program and is in the part of the country that of the schools that just left, you're doing Pac-12. Like, it's got to happen.
Yeah, I think my worry as a San Diego State alum was, I thought, okay, this seems like it's going to be automatic and this is going to happen. And then like you said, you don't know what to believe in realignment rumors. You're like, is the Pac-12 going to like stick together long enough for like San Diego State to even like go in there if the TV deal isn't there? But I think they're obviously in a good spot now. And I think basketball would compete really well. I think it would take football some time. The football programs had success against the Pac-12 school. They beat Utah the year they won the Pac-12 in 2021. And they've beaten some Pac-12 teams, but I think it would take them longer to compete than the basketball program.
I think it's interesting because if you look at what San Diego State's been, certainly Rocky Long, but even Brady Hoke in the last few years. I mean, my crew did the Mountain West title game where they got hit by COVID really hard in that week when they got blown out by Utah State. But that was still a team that won 12 games. Mm-hmm. Just looking at it, I don't know if people realize, because unless you're on the West Coast and the things you said where they did really well, both I feel like them and BYU have acquitted themselves well against the Pac-12 at times. But if you look at it, they've won at least 10 games five times in the last 8 years. And one of those other 3 years when they didn't, that was the COVID year. Mm-hmm. So, and the other 2 years they had winning, they had winning records. So they've been good for a long time. Never mind, you go back to like, obviously, the Marshall Faulk era, or they've had a lot of exciting football.
And they just built that new stadium. Like, I feel like one of the stigmas of that program was like, oh, they play in that decrepit.
It was falling apart
stadium.
Falling apart. Yeah. Holiday Bowl. I remember I went with the year Michigan State played Wazoo. I Fox had the game, so I went with my buddy Dan Weike, who's a Michigan State fan. And he used to, I think he covered the Chargers. So we were going through that, like we were going in one part of the stadium, and like it was falling apart. Like I for safety reasons, I couldn't get over. I was like, wow, this is so much worse than I've even heard.
So I started going to Padre games like 1998, like after they went to the World Series. And it's funny enough, I covered that USC Iowa Holiday Bowl, and that ended up being the last game at Qualcomm. And there's no changes or no updates, no renovations to that stadium in the 21 years or whatever. I went there, and I just remember people complaining about like TV wires like popping out and stuff, and just like Bruce said, like health and safety concerns in that stadium.
Somebody told me yesterday, so small world thing, I'm coaching my daughter's softball team. Yesterday was our picture day, and it just happened to fall right when, like, I'm driving to picture day right when the foul at the end against Creighton, the throw, the replay, all that stuff, like to the point where I was like, we're pulling over and parking here until I can see the end of this. But so one of my assistant coaches is a San Diego State guy. And I get there. I'm like, did you see it? Did you see it? And he told me this stat that I have not verified. Maybe you know it. That San Diego State has the best combined winning percentage in football and men's basketball over the last decade.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's a stat the school like pumps out all the time. I think Ohio State and Oregon are some mix of two and three, but San Diego State's up at the top. And it's just crazy to think about. My first year there was 2010, 2011. And that year, San Diego State made a bowl game for the first time in like 12 years, the first time since like 1998. And that was that fall. And that same fall was the first time that the men's basketball team had like ever been ranked in the top 25. And just the past 12, 13 years, it's been kind of, it's been kind of ascending ever since. And then, you know, they've had a lot of success. I think obviously the Mountain West has changed and BYU and Utah and TCU left, but they've still done a good job of being competitive against Pac-12 schools like we talked about earlier and being the best school in the Mountain West.
Can we use this as a springboard? Before we get to, you know, your day job, which is really on the USC beat, I do want to ask this question. So TCU, I feel like similarly, in a big city, in a fertile recruiting area, was kind of ping-ponging around the group of five-ish stuff. I know that, you know, there was one point for a minute they were in the Big East, but mm-hmm. once they got in the Big 12, and obviously Gary Patterson was there, they got rolling, they wanted a big level, and we saw them just play in the national title game. San Diego State, you have a big recruiting base. There's a ton of talent that has come out of there. As we've said, they've been pretty good. They've been very good at times. And now they've got a new stadium. And they're going to have – it would be interesting to see how much they can leverage this Final Four run right now, too, off of that. Now, I know Brady Hoke is probably not the sexiest name for people at this point, but he's won a lot of games. He's obviously coached in the, you know, at a high level, you know, previously at Michigan. Do we think that San Diego State, if now a group of – going from group of five and if they become a Power Five team – it'd be harder to pull kids out of San Diego if you're going, well, now you're going to be a Pac-12 player regardless. You're in a really good stadium. You can stay home. I don't know if they beat USC or maybe even UCLA for players, but they could beat a lot of probably Pac-12 schools for them. Do we think if they became a Pac-12 school, they could be a consistent top 15 team? Antonio, why don't you go first, and then Stu, I want your thoughts.
I think it would be hard just because – the talent in Southern California, there's not enough. You know, we've talked about this before. There's not enough linemen, but like it was the same question I kind of had in Mississippi. Like, is the state big enough to support two Power Five schools? And I think like, would Southern California be big enough talent wise to support three Power Five schools? Like, right in the reach, right within like 2 hour radius of each other. I think they could like hover around the top 25. I just don't know if they'd be able to consistently get enough talent to be top 15, but I'm kind of curious to see like what coaches would they attract and how that changes the view of them, say like in the coaching carousel, say, you know, the job opens in the future, and what kind of candidates would they be realistically be able to attract if they're in the Pac-12 or something like that. So I think it depends on that to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think a difference there, I get why you brought it up, the TCU comparison, but like, I mean, TCU reached the Rose Bowl as a Mountain West team, top, you know, almost like basically as close to the top of the sport as you could get as a group of five team. And they had Gary Patterson, who we, you know, at his peak was one of the best coaches in the country. You know, San Diego State hasn't quite had that level of breakthrough. So you're starting from a point of, instead of like, can this, same with Utah, right? They had reached the highest level. Can these programs that were at the top of the group of five translate that into their major conferences? And they did. But San Diego State, we're talking like, can they realize some of that unrealized potential maybe while playing against much tougher competition, as Antonio said, in a landscape where, I mean, I think you're going to see, and I'd be curious your thoughts on this, Antonio, you cover recruiting very closely. We're going to start to see a lot of Southern California kids go to the Big Ten when USC and UCLA are in it.
Yeah, I think that's going to open the doors I think that'll open the doors for Big Ten schools in Southern California too, and high school coaches and college coaches I've talked to think, you know, it's going to go both ways. Obviously, it's going to open the doors for like Penn State and Michigan and Michigan State to Ohio State. Obviously,
those already schools like Ohio State has been in Chris Olave, C.J. Stroud. Those are Southern California kids. They've gotten really good players out of here. Michigan has gotten really good players out of California before. Now, the question to me would be, does Illinois, like, I don't
yeah.
even know.
Does it trickle down beyond Ohio State?
Like, yeah.
I'm not sure how many of those schools are going to come in. And, you know, to me, the question I think is more interesting is, does San Diego State now, you know, fend off Utah? And do they fend off some of the other schools like, you know, Oregon State, you know, who they might be able to beat sometime, but like, do they fend off Arizona then for Southern Cal? Because now if you're in the same league, Arizona has come in, as you know, Antonio, really strong in Southern California since Jed Fish has got there. And I'm not saying they won't be able to keep that, but I think that that gives them more of a level playing field to battle that. Now, I think the points you guys both made, I think, are good. I also think one thing that's kind of overlooked at times, and look, I want to add the best young offensive lineman on the West Coast is at Arizona. He's a Hawaii kid. There are a lot of really good big people in the islands that I think they can recruit and that I think they will, you know, probably do that. I'm not, you know, putting my flag down and saying, okay, Brady Hoke is going to have a top 10 team 3 years from now. Or whenever they get, you know, if and when they get in. But I think it'd be interesting. That job will become way more attractive with this, with the facilities upgrade. And so I didn't want to touch on that. But like, now you've been out at USC a bunch. They are a fascinating team. They just had a really strong first year. It didn't end, obviously, the way that any USC fans would want. You know, they get smashed in Vegas by Utah in the second half. And then they get run up and down by Tulane in the Cotton Bowl. What does year two look like at USC right now?
A lot of spotlight on Alex Grinch and what he'll do differently. He hasn't given many details, you know, when we talked to him last week, but I think that's the main focus. Obviously, Caleb Williams, Heisman Trophy winner coming back, the offense. The expectations are obviously high for what they're going to do on that side of the ball with Lincoln and Caleb and all the newcomers and the offensive linemen they brought in and stuff like that. But I think everyone just kind of curious about what this defense is going to look like this year. And I think they've made some good additions on the defensive line and at linebacker. But until those games start, and I don't even know how much we're going to learn in the first 6 weeks because they're playing – San Jose State, Nevada, Stanford, Arizona State, Colorado. That's something we're going to learn more about in the second half of the season when that schedule really gets hard.
Yeah, so it's all about the defense and how much can they improve on defense. And if you go to The Athletic, if you care about USC, first of all, you should be following Antonio. He had on Sunday what I've learned through the second week of practice. And I noticed that a lot of your thoughts had to do with defensive players, whether they is, you know, they had a big transfer from Texas A&M and Anthony Lucas, who was a big time recruit, hadn't really played yet. Then you mentioned a couple of the transfers. So I'm going to take you back a second. You and I covered the Pac-12 title game in Vegas, and we're walking out of the stadium that night trying to find a ride. I think we ended up bumming an Uber off John Canzano. You were kind of pessimistic. You were like, I don't know that they're going to be better next year. Has anything in terms of who they picked up in the portal or what you've seen in practice so far changed your opinion about that?
I think I had a lot of concerns about the offensive line after that game. And obviously it's not the defense side of the ball, but I think they've shored that up to where I think they'll be, you know, maybe even better this year. Still kind of wait and see on the defense. These are, I think, They're obviously not going to have a Tuli Tupelotu, like the one standout guy who's like leading the nation in sacks. I don't think they'll have that. I'm trying to wonder if they'll be better from like 1 through 5 on the defensive line this year with the guys they brought in. Jack Sullivan's a guy who played a lot at Purdue. Keon Bars was somebody who was second team All Pac-12 in 2021 at Arizona, and he has some potential as well. And Anthony Lucas is a body type at 6'5", 270 or 280 that they haven't really had in my 5 years covering USC. So I think the size differential and that will help. I still think they need some more depth on the defensive line. I think linebacker should be better. I think a lot of it comes down to Alex Grinch and if he can solve some of the issues he had last year. I think they could be, the same or maybe better this year, but it wouldn't surprise me if they are better, but the record's worse just because the schedule's harder. You have a trip to Notre Dame, trip to Oregon, Utah, Washington on the schedule this year, UCLA. So I think 10-2, 11-1 is probably one of those is the most realistic, in my opinion.
You think USC fans, real quick, Bruce, do you think – so obviously last year felt kind of like a free year, right? They were 4-8, like anything they – even getting the Pac-12 championship game was a big deal. But if they we assume this is Caleb Williams last season, if they don't make the playoff during his time, would that be a disappointment?
I think so, because if they don't make the playoff, it'll probably be because the defense let them down. And yeah. And everyone wanted Alex Grinch. All the fans wanted Alex Grinch gone after the Cotton Bowl. So if that's what lets them down again, they'll be like, why didn't you just move on from him last offseason? So I think it would be considered a disappointment.
I think what will be interesting is, to me, the two of the more, the players who I think we need to keep an eye on this year are actually not transfers. It's Kalen Bullock, who's a safety who they've been excited about, but physically, really needed a lot more development. And Gentry, who looks like a, really skinny basketball player trying to play middle linebacker. And those guys, I think it's hard to, if you don't have the physicality up the middle, eventually that's going to get you. And I think that got them in the second half of the season. The other thing that I think is a real telltale sign is they got to get better. They got to hold up in the fourth quarter of games in the second half of the year. And it's, I'm glad you said what you said about the schedule, Antonio. Like, I don't know we're going to find out a ton about USC until we get in the second half of the season and really to what happens in the fourth quarter of games. Because if you look at what happened to USC in the fourth quarter in the second half of the season, they were getting shelled. Mm-hmm. And if that team is not physically and mentally ready to stay and fight, then I think that, I think they'll be explosive enough with the skill guys they have and with Caleb and with Lincoln's system to win 10 or 11 games. But to Stu's point, that's going to be a disappointment because they won't be good enough to make a playoff if they're 10-2, or, I don't think you're getting in from the Pac-12 if you're a two-loss team, even if you win your league. And I think that's a big, that's a big question mark. The other thing I think is something that, just to keep in mind, because the way Caleb plays, he's extending plays. He is he got injured in the Utah game, the second game. But I think, it's like he was everything for them. Mm-hmm. And you gotta be mindful of that. It's like almost like live by the sword, die by the sword when you're a quarterback. Is extending plays and plays the way he does. Now he's sturdy. He's a lot bigger than Bryce Young physically, but I do think that, I think they're going to be fascinating to see, because the thing I had always pointed out to people last year was, yeah, they got, Addison and Dye and obviously Caleb on offense. They didn't get those guys on defense. They got a bunch of transfers, and there were some transfers from big schools, but those guys were not really big time players at those schools. And so I think what really has to happen for them to take the next big step is they have got to be able to lure defensive players, and then they got to develop them. Because, and Antonio and I had this conversation a lot. If you look at USC's history, they've had in recent years, certainly under Clay Helton, they had a lot of 4- and 5-star guys. They've just been over recruited. there's so many guys who had no business being five-star guys if you look at what they really were. They have some five-star guys now on the defensive side of the ball who are like, wait, that guy was a five-star because it's not showing up, you know, on the field. And I don't know if it's an issue of how do you develop and make the best of it. But, like, to me, it's really, you know, it goes back to something we've talked a lot about, which is the complementary football and how you practice it and how you manage it. And, you know, that's the part that I think is a big TBD. And if I was a USC fan, I'd be like, okay, I'm encouraged by the improvement. You've definitely made it USC relevant again and exciting. But that's the thing that's going to separate it, whether it can be a playoff national title contender or not.
And I think, you know, on a couple of those points, like, I think the defensive depth, like Bruce talks about body blows all the time. And you look at that schedule, you have Utah and Notre Dame back-to-back weeks. I mean, that's how they ended the season last year. And they didn't have Andrew Voorhees in the title game and some other guys. So their defensive depth is going to be tested, and the depth overall is going to be tested, you know, midway through the season. And they'll still have Washington and Oregon and UCLA after those games. And you know, the recruiting stuff is fascinating because it's like, how are you going to recruit these defensive players when, you know, nobody knows if, you know, how long Alex Grinch will be here and his reputation isn't the best right now. So how are you going to sell the defensive players? Play for me. We'll get you developed and we'll have a great defense this year. And they've done well in the transfer portal, though. I think this year's group is of defensive players and defensive additions is better than last year. It's guys like Bruce said, last year they got Shane Lee and some guys, but like Shane Lee wasn't playing at Alabama. You know, they've got Keon Bars, who was a starter at Arizona, and Jack Sullivan, who was a starter at Purdue, and Mason Cobb, who was a starter at Oklahoma State. So I think this year's group of transfer additions is better. We'll see how much that really improves the defense, though.
Real quick, so Antonio doesn't just cover USC. He covers recruiting, and in particular Southern California recruiting, Pac-12 recruiting. A lot of our writers have recruiting confidentials. Everybody loves them, Marty. We give anonymity, talk to six or seven coaches, and ask them a bunch of questions. And so you did this Pac-12 one. And the very first question was to coaches. These are assistants, recruiting staffers. Which Pac-12 recruiting class impressed you the most in the 2023 cycle? Coach two, none. Being in my former conference, looking at our classes, and looking at the classes in the SEC Big Ten, it's not close as far as the pedigree of football players that schools are able to bring in. The West is not enough anymore. You won't win with just players from the West. Now the others did mention a specific school, but I mean, when he said that, did that kind of raise your eyebrows at all in terms of a coach inside the Pac-12, just basically taking a whole shot at Pac-12 recruiting?
Yeah, I don't agree with it, but it did raise my eyebrows. I think Oregon had a really good class. USC had some good pieces. But I do tend to agree with him in the regard that you can't really win with just West Coast, with only West Coast kids anymore. If you look at USC's national title teams from like 2003 and 2004, the whole starting offensive defensive lines are kids from California. I don't know if you could field a team like that anymore and compete for a national title. And you see teams like Utah who go to Texas a bunch for kids, and you see USC a bit more going to Texas for, you know, the best defensive line recruit they got this year. And Oregon's a pretty national brand. So I think that's one aspect I do agree with, that you can't win just solely based off West Coast. You're going to have to recruit nationally if you want to win, and if you're a Pac-12 school now.
All right. We encourage you, like Stu said, if you are a USC fan, you already should be following Antonio. But also, if you were just a big fan of West Coast recruiting, I would encourage you to follow Antonio. The story that we're talking about inside Pac-12 recruiting, the 2023 signees to watch, best NIL setup, and a subject we cannot get enough of, Deion's impact. Antonio, thanks for joining us on the Audible today.
No problem, guys. Thanks for having me.
thanks to Antonio for coming on. It's been a couple weeks, Bruce, on the emails. We got some great ones this week. And of course, dear listeners, you can always send your questions to the audiblepod@gmail.com. And this first one, I know you have an opinion about. It's from Brian. He says, Stu and Bruce, when discussing the future of the playoff, all the talk centered on the number of teams or whether or not expanding is good for the sport. But why does nobody talk about reforming the makeup of the committee itself and the actual boldface selection process of the teams? How are ADs who have full-time, high-profile jobs the most qualified people to pick the field? What about the flawed metrics the committee does or does not use every year? Each year, the difference between teams 4 and 5 is usually fairly clear for those who follow the sport closely, but the gap between 12 and 13, or 10 and 15 for that matter, is not nearly as obvious. It's a great point. When this thing expands, the selection committee is going to have a lot more, arguably a lot more power and responsibility because they're picking more than 4 teams.
Yeah, I think the tricky part of this is who are you going to get who's A, qualified, B, who's committed? I know this is like the makeup of the committee has come up a lot internally. I know like with my group at Fox Sports, where a few of the people bring up like how many of these people actually were like coaches or played high level football. And it's usually not a huge number. Like there's a handful of people who have the experience, maybe. There's an AD who started out as a GA or played college football years and years ago. But I think it comes back to it is a massive time commitment into be in those discussions. Never mind, you know, people, I don't know how much you get past and go, okay, this person has kind of an allegiance to this school. Do we really buy that there's no biases that you check your, I know they do the symbolic, put your hat at the door, but I don't, you know, you're never going to please everybody on who you have on there. I know like every year, every cycle, there's either a former sports writer or somebody who's like probably didn't have like extensive in the building football, college football experience. Let's say, and this is not, you know, I'm thinking about like retired football coaches. I don't know how many of the retired football coaches, and depending on what stage of their lives are, you know, they're going to have their own biases too. And so it's just a really hard thing. It's a hard formula to solve.
I think that it doesn't concern me at all whether or not the person played football. I mean, you don't need to have played football to evaluate football teams. In fact, I would like to see, one thing I would like to see is an analytics person, and I don't have an exact name for you, a Bill Connolly type who kind of balances this out, but he makes an excellent point about, we have seen ADs in this thing. First of all, whose teams are in consideration, Ward Manuel, the Michigan AD, is on there right now. Jen Cohen, the Washington AD, joins it this year. I'm sure she would like Washington to be part of the playoff discussion next year. We've also had coaches who had coaching searches. You know, they had to fire a coach and hire a new coach like the last week in the week of the season, right as they're getting into the most important, you know, really the only one, frankly, that matters. I'm looking at the makeup for next year. There's a lot of new names here. Chris Ault was a great coach at Nevada. Nobody's going to argue about that. Jim Grove, great retired coach. Those are the only retired coaches, I think, now. And you mentioned there's always a media person. I spent many weeks and many years in press boxes. It's Kelly Whiteside, longtime college football writer for USA Today, who is now out of the business. But every week you get furious with Boo Corrigan or Gary Barta, or whoever was the selection committee chair that week. And that was really just talking about the top four. I mean, we're going to be talking, 6 at-large teams, which means how many teams will be in the mix for that? You'll probably be paying attention to the whole top 20, if they're still doing that ridiculous Tuesday show every week.
Well, two things on that. So first, when you mentioned the analytics, there used to be some version of an analytics component because there was those math formulas that they were using with the BCS. Remember those days?
Yes.
I'm not a fan of that at all. Two, When you said the show, as we know, I hate that show. Like, it's, and I think Reese Davis is really good, but that show's terrible because it, like, I feel like they're trying to drum up controversy of stuff that, you know, it's like you're basically kicking the hornet's nest. And also the person who goes on there, like, as we've talked about, like, the PR aspect of the CFP is atrocious. And that is mismanaged. So it comes out, they look bad for how they message it. You know, they create their own problems. And I get why they do it, because ESPN's paying a fortune and they want TV ratings to tie into it. But that's not going to help, right? I mean, you know, fire your PR people or whatever. Get people who aren't morons or who are actually invested in it to manage it better. And then maybe your message won't. And the person who's the CFP chairman, you know, they're not going to be stuck, you know, dragging out this thing like the way it does. But I don't think that's going to be remedied by whether it's a more untangled committee or more quote unquote qualified committee that they put on. I don't think you solve it that way.
When I said analytics component, I didn't mean like they should have they do, because this is the thing, they do have advanced they use in that room. I would just like somebody who kind of speaks for that community. In fact, there's a great example of that in the basketball process this year. Like, they pay attention to KenPom and that stuff, but it doesn't really drive the discussion. Do you know who the number one team on KenPom is this year?
I have no idea.
UConn. UConn, who was a four seed and who is clearly looks a lot better than a four seed. I just feel like if they had had a KenPom or somebody like that on that basketball committee, they might not have been a four seed.
Analytics work better in other sports than they do in football or in college football, because it's a small sample size and you're all over the place in who you play. I'm not saying analytics has no value in college football. I wouldn't want it in playing a big role in determining who the playoff teams are going to be.
And the other thing with those analytics in college football is they have a preseason component, and it just takes to almost till the end of the season to phase it out. So I wouldn't necessarily want that to play a role in selecting the teams. But I think at the very least, just to give them a final answer, I hope they don't just like, okay, we're just going to keep doing it exactly. Like, there should be an actual hard discussion about, hey, this committee is going to have a lot more responsibility now. Should we maybe take another look at how we want to do it instead of just basically and right ahead with the way it is now. Russell B. in Austin, Texas. You know him as the Michigan fan who enjoyed some Zingerman's on me. Howdy from Texas. A lot of people are posting tongue-in-cheek that because Ryan Day has lost to Michigan 2 years in a row, he's about to be fired. My question is, what would it actually take for him to be fired? Could just losing to Michigan a few times in a row really do it? I expect for the first time in a long time, Michigan will be favored in the big game this year. I don't know about that.
It wouldn't surprise me. This is Jim Harbaugh's most talented team he's had since he's been there, and the game is in Ann Arbor, and they won two in a row. I think this is preposterous, and I'm not taking issue with Russell, but just like, Ryan Day is 45-6 as a head coach, and he's 31-2 in the Big Ten. I get it. He's lost two games, and his team got mauled by Michigan. Those are the two losses. His worst season in four full years as a head coach, they finished sixth. If Ohio State were to fire him, even if they lost 40-0 this year to Michigan and they were 10-2 and they, you know, finished ninth, the idea that they would fire him is insane. Now, I'm not saying, and I don't think there's any credibility to it. I'm sure there's message board folks who are very chafed about that they lost and they're embarrassed because it's unthinkable. You know, Urban won 7-0 right now. What would it take for him to lose? I think it would take to lose his job. I think it would take something unseemly to happen around.
I think it would take some 8-4 season. They're not going to fire him for going 11-1, but losing to Michigan. Now, what will be interesting is in that expanded playoff. I mean, if you're Ohio State, there's going to be an expectation that you make it every year. And that you win games, not necessarily win the national championship, but that you win games in advance in that thing. that would be a double-edged sword if they are losing to Michigan and like getting in there and losing their first round game. But I got to tell you, as long as Ohio State keeps recruiting at the level they're recruiting, I don't see that happening.
Let's use this factor. You take out the Luke Fickell year when Tressel got forced out and Fickell took over and they went 6-7. If you go back, you know how many years in a row Ohio State probably would have made the playoff, a 12-team playoff?
I mean, basically going back to mid-Tressel, I think.
Yeah, 2004, they finished 20th. 2004. Otherwise, and at one point they were in the, you know, they were 7th, you know, but like you have to take out the Luke Fickell year. Now, Urban had a year where they finished 12th. But that's because they lost the Orange Bowl. They would have been a playoff team. They finished 12-2.
Yeah,
and that's so, how
they're every year they'd be in the playoff. So, I think what we might start seeing in the 12-team playoff is if a program like that, or let's say even I don't know, Oklahoma, LSU, just like in the NFL, like making the playoff is going to be seen as a deal breaker. And if you miss the playoff, I would say even 2 years in a row, you might get fired, right? But that means you're finishing the regular season outside the top, most likely outside the top 12.
Yeah. Also, and I'm not saying this should like, yeah. I just going back on the Ryan Day stuff again, and I know lots of coaches, you know, do really good things. Like Ryan Day has actually been like a leader in some really important mental health issues. Like he's gone out and spoke and handled it. Like he's definitely been somebody Ohio State should be very proud of, that he's in the leadership spot. So I get it. They lost to Michigan 2 years in a row. I'm sure nobody in Columbus or nobody Ohio State fan is just like, and I'm not pushing back on Russell because I know he asked the question. I just think it is, I think it's so ridiculous that it.
Harbaugh lost to Ohio State 5 years in a row and didn't get fired. So, granted, there, you know,
the issue was there that they were not winning at the level before when right. He was there against Ohio State. You know,
this one, no name, just Shadow of Death Valley. Hey, Stu and Bruce, in the most recent episode, you both talked about covering the sport for multiple decades, and Bruce alluded to knowing Tom Herman since he was a GA at Texas. Given your collective tenure, are there particular coaches you have known and covered whose evolution and career trajectories stand out in your mind, watching these guys rise from players or GAs to head coaches of prominent programs must make for fascinating theater as you cover the sport?
Yeah, one of the more prominent ones for me is, like, I remember going to Texas Tech and having a student worker, you know, kind of find Leach for me in the building. And as we were walking, I was talking to this guy, you know, the whole way about his background and everything. And that was Lincoln Riley, you know, and been, you know, kept up with him. Obviously when they went, a bunch of those guys ended up going to East Carolina, saw him. That's actually the only time I've ever been to Greenville. So it's been interesting, although not shocking, to see him ascend, because everybody there knew how smart he was. There's a lot of other guys just because I've covered it for a long time. I'm going to guess your answer on this, because it's your alma mater, that you probably covered Pat Fitzgerald. And then, is that your answer?
Yeah, I covered Pat Fitzgerald as a player in the mid 90s. So, and obviously was at school with him at the same time. So, I mean, there's nobody I've watched.
On a relatively small campus, I'm curious, like, what was Pat Fitzgerald's, was he looked at as like, because your campus was different than a lot of other Big Ten campuses.
Yeah, but the football program players were still pretty, like, they spent, you know, all day at the football building, and the stadium was a mile from campus. So it wasn't like I was walking a class. Now, also, as great as he was, really the bigger star at the time was Darnell Autry, their running back, who was a Heisman finalist. And one summer, our fraternity was being renovated. So we were in the one summer I stayed at school, fraternity was being renovated. So we were in like this temporary house that was also available to other students. And Darnell Autry was living in the house at the time. But mostly I don't think I would like run into Pat Fitzgerald walking around campus. But I can tell you this, the guy you see now is exactly who he was personality wise as a player.
One of my trips to Northwestern, he had probably been the head coach for like 5 years. I remember sitting with him and asking him, because he was so good in college, and it kind of boggled my mind that he couldn't have like lasted at least a few years in the NFL.
Yeah.
And so we were talking about like that. And it was interesting because he had such an awareness of, yeah, I don't have the change of direction, the agility to play at that level. And just to see how big, and him knowing the difference between that and him seemingly, and again, this is how what I remember him saying, was like, he seemed to be very at peace with like how it played out. You know, I think he would, you know, obviously he's a Chicago guy through and through. And the connections there in the NFL, I think were, you know, it was just interesting to hear. Cause you know, you hear of so many guys who are like, they're going down with their boots on kind of thing, and they're not giving up on it. And I'm not saying he gave up on it, but he just kind of was like, seemed to be very, and maybe that's what's made him a good coach, is he had the awareness to go, okay, I know what's real and what's, you know, he obviously can rest on winning, you know, two Butkuses. I think he won two Butkuses, right?
He did. Yeah. He lasted one, like, he didn't even make it to training camp. I think he went to mini camp with the Cowboys, and that was it. And I was pretty baffled too. Like, how can you be that accomplished a college football player and the NFL has no interest in you? But he's pretty good sense of humor about how he just wasn't a great athlete. He just, you know, was a really instinct. Those were the days. There, I don't know that there are a lot of players like that these days, right? Like the just kind of like tough nosed, instinctual middle linebacker who tackles everybody, who's not an NFL player. A couple others that come to mind for me, covered. I mean, these aren't college coaches, but covered Ken Dorsey as a college player. Obviously, he's now probably on the cusp of being an NFL head coach. I've known Lane Kiffin since he was an assistant at USC, probably 2004-ish, probably when they were starting to win national titles there. Same with Sark, actually. They were co-OCs at the time. I'm looking down the list here of college head coaches to see if there's anybody else quite like that. What about you?
Yeah, there's a bunch of guys that just, you remembered it. Like, I remember being at, this is maybe a little off the spotlight, but like, I remember going to Illinois and talking to Nate Shielhouse, and now Nate Shielhouse is, yep, the offensive coordinator at Iowa State, and he's fast rising. And I know he's was in the mix for a head coaching job at one point. And I remember talking to an AD who was really impressed with him, you know, and it's like, he's not, you know, like Jerry Neuheisel is somebody who's going to be a head coach before too long. And, you know, it's funny because from conversations with Chip Kelly over, you know, I know three of the guys he's especially high on, and one is Cody Whitfield, you know, who's now on his staff. The other one is Connor McQueen, who I remember sitting in the quarterback room when Johnny Manziel was there, and Connor was, you know, was the walk-on who didn't look like he was a SEC football player, who was super smart. And I'm like, oh yeah, this guy, if he wants to be a big time coach someday, I'm sure he's going to be, because he can relate to people and he's really smart. And so it's been fun to watch people's careers kind of ascend like that. And you can see it from quarterbacks, whether they were, you know, because I think there's a leadership component, there's an accountability component, you know, that's already in there. But yeah, there's just a bunch of guys. I mean, certainly when I was around, all the time I was around Texas Tech, a lot of those guys, not just the quarterback guys, you know, you can see, I think they take advantage of the football program that they're in. They know the system that they're in, and then they network really well. So, I mean, that's been a really cool thing about just kind of covering the coaching beat. You see these people, go, it's interesting, 'cause the question that we just got, you know, kind of ties to Tom Herman and his GA days. I'm sure I've told this story before. So the reason why, that was my first coach's convention, was in California, and I was there to do a story on how to break into the coaching business. And I ended up going drinking with a bunch of GAs, and the guy I ended up doing the story with was a GA for Oklahoma State under Bob Simmons, Brian Yauger, who became a buddy of mine. And he's no longer in coaching, but you know, it was around a lot of drinking. We had a good time. And that question, I think, tees up to our last question. And that is from Adam in Derby, Connecticut. Hey, Bruce and Stu, I took a tour of Jerry World, AT&T Stadium.
Wait. Before you do that, Bruce, I figured you were going to mention Manny Diaz. Do you want to mention him?
Yeah, if you want to ask me about it, because, I mean, I worked with Manny Diaz.
Yeah, I'm just going to. So this is what I was going to say. So maybe take out the drinking part. I'm surprised you, there's somebody that I know you've known for a long time. I'm surprised you haven't mentioned them because you've known them since before they were actually in coaching. You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah. So when I started at ESPN, Manny Diaz started almost the exact same time. And he had just come from Florida State where he was a student and was really sharp. And, you know, back in those days at ESPN in Bristol, you just had like a really commonality with people because you were probably a huge sports fanatic. And he was. And Manny was on the fast track as a producer. But he obviously had a dream that probably a handful of people did to work in football, but he really pursued it. And, you know, thanks to Chuck Amato and to Sterling Sharp, who had worked at ESPN at the time, Sterling did, he got his foot in the door. When I say foot in the door, it was like he basically had another job and was working in the recruiting office for nothing. And, you know, he had a young family. And so it's been really cool to see Manny's career take off the way it has. And, you know, like it just, I think in some ways, like, you know, working at ESPN was kind of the dream job for a lot of people. And I think, I'm sure he, you know, I don't know, I'd be curious what he thinks he would have done if he just stayed in the TV. But I think the cool part was he took a big chance bet on himself because he didn't want to wonder what if. And I think those are the things that are like really good, you know, lessons to take a chance, because you don't want to ever have the I wish I had done that when I had the chance. Because I mean, at the time, I feel like he was already married, and I think he maybe at one point when he moved back to Tallahassee, his wife might have been pregnant. So it was like, that was, you know, it's one thing to do it when you're on your own. I mean, you know, you can work a second job because you don't have a family or entanglements or anything like that. He really made it work. So it's been awesome to see him kind of get to where he got. All right. So just to tie into that question was the Tom Herman piece. I got to meet Tom when I was at a coaches convention. It was my first convention, and I was working on a story for ESPN Magazine about how to break into the business as a coach. And so I went drinking with a bunch of GAs, and the GA I did the story on ultimately was a GA for Oklahoma State, Brian Yauger, who became a buddy and stayed in coaching for a while and ended up leaving the business. But I think that's the subject of alcohol, I think, is a good transition to this one from Adam in Derby, Connecticut. Hey, Bruce and Stu, I recently took a tour of Jerry World /AT&T Stadium in Texas, and the tour guide brought us into the press box. He told us that journalists have access to unlimited food and beverages, including alcohol. I knew journalists got free food, but I was shocked to hear about unlimited alcohol. Is this true? If so, do some journalists go overboard? There must be a crazy story or two you can share on the pod without naming names. Do I have to ask you, what's the most drunk you've ever seen Ari Wasserman in a press box?
Why is it always Ari as the example? Adam, I think your tour guide had bad information. I mean, maybe he's thinking of the suites, like the luxury suite holders. I've never, ever been in a press box with unlimited alcohol. I have been in a few, maybe like on actual college campuses, where once everybody was done filing their stories, oh, hey, look, there's a cooler of beer in the back.
I don't think I've like on that. I never mind the college campus. I've definitely been in press boxes where after the game and maybe after the people come back into the press box to work on their stories, there have been some folks who have like had a couple of cases of beer and maybe they will ask anybody if they want a beer or two. I'm not sure if I can remember seeing anybody with like open bar where there's like hard liquor in
there. No, and definitely not during the, wait, so you're saying you saw people like writers brought their own cases of beer or the team?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying where maybe media relations staff has had, you know, has had a bunch of beer and it's available and they'll ask somebody, do you want a beer or something?
Yes.
That's not like a college campuses thing. Like I've seen that at, you know, like press boxes I've been in.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I meant in a press box, but I was thinking it was in a college stadium, but maybe it was a pro stadium, but you're right. It was the SID who had them. And But no, have you ever been in a press box where somebody showed up intoxicated?
I don't think so. I've been in, had a conversation with every person in there. Like, I've definitely been in press boxes where there are lots of random people in there who may not be writing off the game. And who knows? Like, I've been in a couple of stadiums where there have been people who, they're not technically sports writers or media. They may just be there because that's where somebody's putting them in there. And you can hear, like, it's like no cheering in the press box. You may get some of that from them. So I couldn't tell you if, like, they were tailgating beforehand, but it's not like somebody is coming around and like, you're ready for another, like that I've not seen. But
I should also just say that, again, this tour guide really did a good job of glamming it up here. Yes, journalists get free food. 98% of the time, that free food is not like the food they're serving in the luxury suites or gourmet food by any means.
Most times I feel like people will go into, like, we'll get their own food and they'll go buy it at somewhere else in the stadium.
I do that, but I don't think, I mean, most people just sit and eat the
best press box food you can remember having.
It would have been at a pro stadium for sure. Do you have a ready answer for that?
And this is from doing sideline and some Big 12 games, I kind of feel like both TCU and Oklahoma State would have pretty good food. It's definitely not what Tim served at USC. I know that.
Like, just to give the listeners a window into, so I would say most your standard. Well, first of all, in the SEC, it's almost always barbecue. In fact, SEC and like the Texas Big 12 schools, it's almost always barbecue, but it's not Andy Staples barbecue. Let's see, other common ones like lasagna, like hamburgers that look like they've been sitting in that tray for a couple days by then, cold cuts. Ohio State has a unique one. I don't know if they still have it. At one point, they had a Frosty machine in there because of the Wendy's tie-in. And then
I have not been in like Ohio State's press box very often because we're at the games, but we're not up there. Like, I'm at the games, but I'm not, like, the only places I felt like I would try to make a point to go, for some reason, like I said, TCU and Oklahoma State, I thought kind of stood out as like, all right, the food is worth me coming up here for a little bit before the game. I don't know. Like, their food I thought was better than what we usually were getting off the TV truck for what the crew was getting.
So now we sound like total complainers. Like, yes, there is free food.
Cut this segment.
No, we're not going to cut the segment. I realize, having been to the NCAA tournament as a fan the other week, I realized that stadium food is very expensive. And so free food would be very appealing to some people. But this question from the, or this description that the tour guide at Jerry World gave is like, we're basically sitting in there eating filet mignon and drinking, the finest liquor while watching a football game. I just want to clear up that if anybody has that perception, that is not it.
Okay, as always, send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com, and we will see you next time.